Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jenny Lee from the University of Arizona. Today, our guest is Dr. Gabriela Lukacs, professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh. Her new book, Invisibility by Design, Women and Labor in Japan's Digital Economy, was published by Duke University Press earlier this year. This book examines the relationship between young women and digital economy in contemporary Japan. In particular, it focuses on the inequalities born in the development of such a high-speed growth of digital economy. Welcome, Gabby. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I very much appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. So Japan's cute culture has recently become a quite heated topic in academic studies of contemporary Japan. What specific aspects of it drew you into this project?
That's actually how the project started. The first chapter was about net idols, and it ended up then being the second chapter, but that was the very first project or very first topic that drew me to this research project about Japan's digital economy and women's place in it. So originally, cute culture was a subculture that young women developed in the 80s, but by, let's say, the mid to late 90s, cute had grown into a lucrative global commodity. And examples include Sailor Moon and Pokemon that Anne Ellison wrote about, or Hello Kitty that Cristiano wrote a book about, which are all great great studies of cute culture in Japan. But it was, in addition to these studies, it was Sharon Kinsella's article about cute culture that came out in an edited volume in the 90s that kind of made me think about cute culture that inspired me to a little bit look more into how young women harness cute culture to develop do-it-yourself careers in Japan's emerging digital economy. And in reading Sharon Kinsella's essays, what interested me was the emphasis on this contradiction that the productionist cute, on one hand, is this project of empowerment, while on the other, as a particular behavior, disposition, or aesthetic sensibility, it signifies vulnerability, submissiveness, and even silliness. So there's a kind of a contradiction between these two approaches to cute culture, and my chapter on net idols aimed to unpack this contradiction and think how women strive to extract value from something that in the end ends up re-anchoring them to a gender division of labor within which their opportunities are limited and often their autonomy is curtailed. So if I don't want to be crude, but what I mean is something like, adopting cute behaviors and cute looks helps women to get ahead, but it also sets limits to them and reconnects them to disenfranchisement and what we could theorize or conceptualize as a highly gender stratified labor market in Japan. So that is what I was thinking about.
That's I'm really glad you wrote this book at this time, because recently I see a lot of media representation, especially in Hollywood movies, trying to kind of capture this cuteness, Japanese style cuteness. But I think Hollywood is getting it all wrong. So I'm really glad that you wrote a book to talk about this issue. And although we can see representation of Japan as a high-tech country in Western media, the history of it may not be a familiar topic to many. So can you talk about the background of Japan's rapid digital media growth and its social cultural context?
Absolutely. So Japan, for a long time, Japan was ahead of the United States in developing mobile phones. And it's indeed curious. This is something that I've been long thinking about and thinking of writing about. I will probably never do it, but it would be a good project that why Japanese producers of consumer electronics like Sony, Panasonic, Fujitsu, or Kyocera did not become global producers of cell phones like Samsung or Apple did. Because as I explain in the book, Japan was ahead of most advanced capitalist countries in developing mobile internet services. And it has a lot to do with life in a large city like Tokyo, where there are 14 million people and a lot of people spend an average of 2 hours commuting a day. So mobile internet services helped deal with the tedium of commuting, right, in a large city like Tokyo. So in 1993, NTT Docomo introduced the personal digital cellular system, and in 1999, NTT launched iMode, which were all commercial internet, which was a commercial internet service that used cellular phones as end terminals. And then other providers like KDDI and JPhone also started offering similar services. So I think the main point here is that in Japan, internet use was mobile, right? And then the US was ahead of the United States, for instance, and many other advanced capitalist countries in developing internet services for mobile internet services or offering mobile internet services. And perhaps another unique aspect of Japan's cell phone culture that is worth mentioning, because one of the chapters is about cell phone novels, is that in Japan, I'm not sure whether that's still true, but in Japan, the cell phone was perceived for a very long time as an intimate medium. And it also accelerated the commercialization of the internet, because unlike personal computers that might be shared, or they're personal, but computers are more likely to be shared than cell phones, right? Which meant that the cell phone as a medium itself made identification easier, and that kind of helped commercialize the internet in Japan. And maybe the third one is that in what I understand from colleagues' work is that young people often use their cell phones more as a texting device rather than to access the internet and to text rather than as a phone. And it's not so much that they create new relationships, but they use it as a technology to maintain existing relationships. So they exchange text with 3-5 friends and their family members. So I think these are the aspects that are relevant to the arguments I make in the book. But please feel free to ask additional questions if I didn't answer the ones that you
that's
asked.
That's very interesting. I mean, now that you mentioned, I can't even remember when was the last time I had a phone call with my friend. I guess using phone as intimate media for texting alone is not just a Japanese thing anymore. But to return to the book, in what way were women involved in this digital activity, this digital labor?
So the argument I make in the book is that in Japan, the digital economy was built on women's uncompensated labor. Or in other words, women's uncompensated, unpaid labor was essential to developing and expanding the Japanese economy. I mentioned earlier that Japan's labor market is gender stratified, which means that during the post-war period, gender served as a readily available criterion by which a reserve of unskilled labor could be maintained or shut down as business cycles fluctuated. And Japan had a system of job security called the system of lifetime employment, but it started eroding in the 90s, and women were excluded from this system anyway. So in this context, as the digital economy started emerging, a lot of women who did not find work that they perceived as meaningful in the traditional labor market turned to the digital economy to develop what I call DIY careers. Careers that often, before they developed them, they didn't even exist. And there are examples in the book.
Great. And I guess we can jump into these examples now. Mm-hmm. In the first chapter, you talk about female photographers' participation in digital economy and how they actually suffered from such participation. Now, why is that? Why did they suffer?
Yes. And this is a story that is repeated in the context of the net idol phenomenon in many ways. So the women photographers preceded the emergence of Japan's digital economy because the ones I analyzed started their careers in the early 90s. Yes, which was before the internet. The internet was mainstream by the late 90s in Japan. Like the first time I went to Japan was 95, and I still remember like the blue screens, like you had to go to the university to access your email really the point, I think what's important here is that the photographers, the argument I make in the book that women photographers paved the way to the net idol trend that I analyze in chapter two, who then catalyzed the development of social media and blogging platforms. So that's kind of the trajectory of how the internet evolved, or what the role of women was in the development of the internet. So the commonality between women photographers and net idols is the engagement with cute culture, which is most often also a critical reflection on cute culture. So what many women photographers did was that they took pictures of flowers like Ninagawa Mika, or their cute girlfriends or cats. But these pictures prompted photography critics to be dismissive and to not take them seriously. And at best, what they came up with, and I'm thinking of people like Izawa Kotaro, who came up with this idea that, perhaps it's a particular genre of photography, which he called girly photography. But this concept itself was something that rubbed a lot of these women the wrong way. They thought it was dismissive and paternalizing. But to return to the commonality between photographers and net idols, many photographers produced, for instance, they produced nude or semi-nude self-portraits, which is a popular genre within photography. And women said that they took pictures of themselves as a means of self-exploration, but also because they did not have access to models like men photographers did, who often worked with models who wanted to be photographers, so who simply just volunteered their free labor so that they would be able to learn from the master or whatever, however we describe it. But often, so when asked women photographers about why they took semi-nude or nude pictures of themselves, they said, well, if I had models, I would have taken pictures of them, but I just didn't have access to them. And then it was also a means of self-exploration. But what's interesting is that critics do not see these projects as projects of self-exploration. Or as a critical involvement or critical reflection on representation and how women are represented, are photographed and objectified, and the male gaze and all that. That's not the way critics saw these pictures. They simply looked at them and they thought, well, these are semi-nude gravure or grabia photos that you can see in the in men's magazines. And also they were dismissive thinking and saying that these women were exhibitionists. So they did not understand what women were trying to do. And that was tricky because the argument I make in the chapter is that although women started their careers by taking pictures that could be understood as girly or that kind of could be seen as endorsing a particular cute sensibility or a particular aesthetic sensibility that you could describe as cute. At the same time, many of them developed their own styles and their own kind of genres, but photography critics didn't see them, which then did not help women to develop careers as professional photographers. So that kind of limited their opportunities of what they could do, because that's kind of a question to me, like why Nina Gavamika, who was very famous at this point, probably world famous, kept shooting pictures of flowers for so long. I don't know if this answers your question. Please feel free to follow up, and then I'll elaborate on whatever else is left unanswered.
Yeah, it does. And I wanted to tie this to your next chapter, which talks about netto idol or net idol. Internet idols. As you said, these female photographers' participation online really kind of what could be considered as the precedent of net idol industry.
Yeah.
Now that we have numerous net idol groups, whether publicly or underground, it has become such a huge industry and so complicated that it's beyond just cute girls singing and dancing anymore. We have all these, like the AKB48, all the voting system, all the election system. So what changes have happened from the first appearance of net idol? And what do they tell us about the social changes that have happened in Japan in general?
It's a really good question, but also a difficult one. So the connection between cuteness and women's celebrity is, of course, precedes the net idol phenomenon. Like, we know that. That's no news. And net idols were micro celebrities, right? Which is a form of idol status that the digital economy made possible. So in the context of analog media, there's also a push to produce idols that are more accessible. And you mentioned AKB48, which is an excellent example. There's a great volume about this by Jason Carlin and Pat Galbraith, right? Like this idea that to produce this idol group that is that is more accessible than mainstream celebrities, who produced in ways that there's really no connection between them and fans anymore, because their work condition, labor conditions are such. And I'm thinking of something like SMAP, that this boy band that disbanded a few years ago, but SMAP started in the 80s, actually a long time ago. What was it, late 80s or something like that? And you know, they were idols who literally would show up on television every day. But with that schedule, you can't cultivate relationships with fans. So there's the point. I'm sorry, I'm belaboring it a little too much. But what I'm trying to say is that there's a push in the analog media industries to customize the kind of relationship a little bit between fans and idols. And net idols try to capture that niche. Like what I say in the chapter is that they were what the Japanese call bokudake no aidoru, or this that they are only my idols, which wasn't true. But an average net idol had about 30 fans, and that was manageable in terms of exchanging emails with them every day and remembering their birthdays, and it's like cultivating relationships with them. So I'm thinking it was still an awful lot of work for net idols, because most of them had full-time jobs. So they often complained that they would get home after a full-time, after a full day's work, and then they had 30 emails to respond to. But in terms of, so I wonder if it's a social trend or more like an economic trend, which is a growing demand for customization in general, in the service industries and also in the media industries, which is a little bit more difficult in Japan, right? Because television is still domestically produced for domestic audiences, and it's still a mass medium. But exactly because of that, the digital economy was able to capture kind of a particular niche, that, you know, people who were more interested in getting some response than cultivating a relationship with someone who they could never reach or never actually talk to. And I'm thinking also about meat cafes and Galbraith's wonderful book about meat cafes, like this idea that you know, why otaku go to meat cafes. So you were asking me about the trends, and I'm wondering if it's a social or an economic trend. But the social aspect of it is definitely women's marginalization from employment that they see as meaningful and that they see as a source of personal growth. So these women who were not optimistic about their job prospects or they were frustrated with their jobs, learned some basic coding and created their own websites, and they learned to produce content. And they became photographers inspired by the girly photographers, or some of them became poets. I analyzed in the chapter a photographer and two net idols in more in depth. One of them became a poet, the other became a photographer and a phototherapist. And they paved the way, so net idols paved the way to the development of social media platforms and also blogging platforms. So originally they used what's called Nikki Saito or diary platforms, but some of them learned some basic coding to create their own websites. But the more and more of them started doing this, that kind of inspired entrepreneurs to develop platforms around the activities of these women, invite them there, and then develop practices of selling advertising online. So that was the banner advertising at that point.
So is this what you argue about how digital economy grows to exploit human capital?
That's right. So the human capital, yes, that's yes and no. What I argue in relation to the net idols is that I use it as an example to show how women became conduits for developing platforms, because they were the ones who produced the content, and venture capitalists tended to be men in Japan. The people who actually had the money were able to raise the capital to develop these platforms. But what women did was that they produced content, and by producing content, they attracted fans to their sites. And then the way venture capitalists entered the picture was that they were thinking, wow, I mean, these are particular markets that could be sold to manufacturers, advertisers. And that way, you know, from content production, you could produce profit while not actually employing workers. So, but the women, very few of them were actually able to develop careers from a net idol career. Like the one whose career analyzed the poet, she works for her family business, and the other one still makes money from working for an advertising company. So it's rather that women put in all the work, which was kind of aspiration or hope labor, but they were not the ones who benefited from this, if this makes sense.
Did the same thing happen to their...
Yeah, go ahead.
Did the same thing happen to their blogging websites as well?
The issue about human capital is that the digital economy exploited women's labor through the idea. So the idea of human capital development were essential to exploiting women's labor, because human capital originally is an idea that investment in education would improve employability. Right? But the neoliberal version of human capital development is a theory that emphasizes more the speculative nature of investment. This idea that whatever you do, whatever you invest labor and time into, might appreciate or might depreciate your human capital. And because of that, you have to make good choices about how you appreciate your human capital. So the underlying message here is that success or failure entirely depends on you, which is a very neoliberal idea, right? That you know, the idea that unemployment is voluntary because there's always work, and if you don't want to work, that means you don't want to work. And it kind of offers a totally depoliticized approach to identity, subjectivity, and it underplays structural or pattern forms of inequality, and the idea of social mobility. So in the context of blogging, what blogging platforms promoted was this idea that everyone had a unique personality, and that uniqueness could be transformed into content, right? And because of that, it was that you could learn something, you could just read these self-help books, and you develop your unique personality, and then you become a blogger, and you transform that would become your content. So the proposition was that everyone had an equal chance to succeed in the digital economy, which I call technological utopianism, or simply put, that everyone is a potential Mark Zuckerberg. But that's really not the case, because not everyone has the time and the resources to create that killer food blog, or fashion, especially fashion blogs, right? Which you need an awful lot of money to create a successful fashion blog. So what I found in Japan was that, ironically, most famous bloggers, many of the most famous bloggers actually came from wealthy backgrounds, because they were the ones who had the time and the energy to experiment, to experiment with a new technology. Many of the people who actually succeeded were first adopters of the technology. So they just so in that chapter, what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to problematize this idea that everyone is a potential Mark Zuckerberg, because that's clearly not true. And at the same time, emphasize that by selling that dream or selling that idea or promoting that idea, platform owners are able to extract surplus value from women who produce, and it was, who produce content hoping to become famous bloggers. And I'm saying women because in Japan, of course, there are a lot of men bloggers as well. But women tended to outperform men in terms of popularity, and there were a lot more of them than men bloggers. But curiously, and this is actually ironic, that just like in the case of online traders, bloggers who are able to make money from this career make money not from affiliate advertising, but by writing self-help books about or tutorials about how to become a famous blogger, which I find really ironic. And then those books were mainly written by men, not by women. So women produce the content, and by producing content for a blogging platform like Amoeba, they enhance the brand value of the platform. They draw advertisers to the platform. So they produce profit for the platform owners, but very few of them succeed as bloggers, right? And then the ones who write the blogging tutorials are not the women, which is ironic. So it's about that. But that is what I mean by saying that the idea of human capital development was essential to mobilizing women to free labor and then using that labor to expand Japan's digital economy. Just this idea that human capital is speculative and anyone can do it.
That is so fascinating. And strangely, what you describe about human capital sounds a lot like grad school and academia.
I know, but like I said, that's not the point.
So in the next chapter, your focus shifts to online trading, which you'll mention is a more sensitive area because of the limitations by Japanese law. And a lot of women are participating in online trading. But just like the blogging platforms, the trading industry is still largely male-dominated. We talked about a bit of why, how women tend to have to, like the net idol or blogging, they have to maintain a full-time job during the day and then they come home to do this. But what are some of the, I guess, social cultural context that's behind this online trading that that failed to make women the leading members of this industry?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And that is, it was an interesting chapter. It's interesting how these different chapters came together, because I think that came from a New York Times article that I read about trading, Japanese housewives trading, and this kind of Japan bashing tone that, the housewives are now, Japanese housewives are now are having an impact on the global economy. And it's like, what is happening there? And then I started interviewing them, and what I learned was exactly what I learned in the context of the blogging trend, that the most famous women traders actually made money from, not from trading, but from writing books about how to become a successful trader. Which I thought, what is happening here? But to answer your question, I wonder if there isn't a parallel between the word of chefs and the word of traders, that, you know, professional chefs often are men, but the individuals, the family members who cook at home are more like rather the women. And in trading, in the context of trading, there's something similar. So I wonder if it has to do with the public-private divide, because in Japan, women were encouraged to, encouraged to use these online platforms. The idea was that now that these online platforms are available, you can use smaller amounts of money to start building a portfolio and start doing day trading or stock trading online. But my understanding is that most women could barely break even. So it's not that this was online trading was a way to make money. It was just some made a little money, most didn't. A lot of them squandered their savings. So it was deceptive. But your question was about why it is that women did not, because what I argue in the chapter is that although there was this so-called women trader phenomenon and women wrote books about online trading and encouraged their fellow homemakers to be involved in trading, that doesn't mean that these women paved the way to other women or for other women to an inroad or paved the way for these women to the professional trading or like so it's not that women had better chances to be professional brokers, because often the women who wrote the tutorials emphasized, and that's another ironic aspect of all this, that this is online trading is something anyone can do, and they kept saying how stupid they themselves were, and which wasn't true. I met some of them, and they were really bright people. But in order to sell the idea to other homemakers to buy the book and to kind of draw them to online platforms, trading platforms, they had to kind of present themselves as the kind of the tada no shufu, or what I call them, like the housewife from the next house, which and then they kept saying how stupid they were, but that kind of also undermined them in some ways, if that makes sense. So there were all these kind of contradictions that women who wrote these books couldn't better mediate. So in some ways, they undermined themselves. In other ways, by emphasizing that they were homemakers, and they tried to they also tried to comply with conventional expectations that a middle-class woman's place is in the home. And so they, when they gave interviews, they emphasized that, oh, I only do trading for 10 minutes a day because I don't want it to interfere with my children's schedule. And it's like, no, you can make that much money if you only do trading for 10 minutes. That's all a lie, right? But so because, and I mentioned this in the chapter too, that the conservative pundits did attack these women that they should be focusing on their children's education. They should not destroy the basis of a manufacturing of an economy that is based on hard work and the idea of hard work and everything that is the opposite of financial speculation. Which, of course, I agree that's volatile and that's not necessarily good. But these women were attacked by conservative pundits. And because of that, they defended themselves as no. They understood that they were housewives and they were stupid because on and on and on. Right. So I think that these were important factors why women who wrote tutorials about online trading were not able to kind of undermine the gender inflexibility in the financial sector and did not open doors for other women to become professional brokers, because I don't think that happened. It's still a heavily male-dominated industry.
Yeah, and that's in a way sad to witness. Mm-hmm. Now, chapter 5 of your book looks into cell phone novelists, which might be a very unique phenomenon in Japan. Since when did women become interested in cell phone novelists, and why cell phone? Why not other ways? Mm-hmm. And when there are more and more online platforms available for women to write and publish on, how has this phenomenon of cell phone novelists transformed?
That's a very good question again. So my understanding is that cell phone novels actually appeared in other countries as well. But there are also the cell phone novel phenomenon started before online novel platforms were developed. So what happened was that these were originally posted on this diary type of site or whatever grew out of diary sites. Novel sites, and then they then became cell phone novels. So why cell phone novel first, or why cell phone, why the medium? And I mentioned earlier, maybe before I get to that, there are there are novel platforms, international, like Wattpad, for instance, that I've heard of, or web novel. But in Japan, although chronologically this doesn't work now that I think about it, because these were developed much, much more recently. So maybe let's go back to Japan and this. Let's start with this idea of why cell phone, what you asked. So what I mentioned earlier was that so the cell phone itself is kind of an intimate medium, and it has to do with commuting, like many Japanese people spend a lot of time on commuting, and they kind of want to make that a little bit less boring and alienating. So what's unique about the technology is, or maybe the genre, is this idea to use small flip phones to write novels, because they were not even the larger tablet-like cell phones. And they were written, the original cell phones were written on, and we are talking about the 2000s, mid-2000s, they were written on these flip phones. And there were arguments about whether they could be written on computers or whether some cell phone novelists actually cheated and they wrote theirs on computers. And the editors I talked to said that, no, you cannot write them on computers, because the kind of the flow would be different. Like the technology itself determined the literary style. And this is not something, because you can only write short sentences. And some of them even said that by the time they finished writing a couple of chapters or a chapter, their fingers were bleeding. I don't know how that, I never tried to write. I literally read that, and this was not something that only I heard once. So, but what I'm saying is that there was a connection between the technology itself and the literary style. And it had to be short sentences. And one thing that I didn't do much work on in the chapter was this idea that you know, what the cell phone novel did to the literary establishment itself. Give me a second, I lost my train of thought. So like, yeah, the connection between the cell phone technology and the language itself, that sometimes I, you know, when I read a paper that is not well written, an undergraduate paper, and it's like, did you write it on your cell phone, right? So it's but it was intentional. It was intentional, because often what cell phone novelists did was that they bought themselves and they perpetuated this idea of technological utopianism, because they made this argument that you know, the cell phone and the internet were technologies that enabled anyone to write a novel. So they, in many ways, they attacked the literary establishment itself, that it was no longer about educational pedigrees and about apprenticeship and whatever, but you could do it. And often they were popular because they were awkward. They were not well-written. They were full of grammatical infelicities. but that made them more accessible, because it kind of perpetuated the same idea of technological utopianism, that if this became famous, then I could write one too, right? If that makes sense. And then, some like Mahuno Airando or Magic Island, by the mid-2000s, it had like 1 million novels. So it's a lot of people tried. Let me see. So scholars did suggest that the cell phone is seen as an intimate technology, and the young women used to customize their cell phones far beyond choosing, covers for them, right? You remember those little hanging things from them? They use them to wake them up. Often people argue, who read cell phone novels, argue that it makes a difference how you read, that you can't just read them anywhere. So it's kind of a ritual, and you can't just read them on the train, for instance. I need to ask you to help me with the question. That the question was about the relationship between a literary form and the technology, or why this technology?
Yeah, and how has this phenomenon of cell phone novels transformed when we have more and more platforms to write and publish on?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for the clarification. We do, but that's not a cell phone anymore, because I think that's then the answer is that there is a very intimate and close connection between the literary form and the technology. When you start writing a cell phone novel on a computer, that's no longer a cell phone, because the rhythm of the sentences is not the same. And I I actually asked some of the editors that I interviewed at Starts and Takeshobo, and I asked them, like, because most cell phone novels are anonymous, and I asked them, like, isn't it possible that some of you actually write these novels? And he told me, one of them flat out told me that there's just no way they could do it, because it has to be a flip phone. It has to be. So I don't know. I also have to admit that I did not follow up on what happened to cell phone novels in Japan. So I don't know how the form changed, there was an insistence that the real authentic cell phone novel has to be written on a flip phone.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I guess the only way to find out is for me to read some of these cell phone novels.
Have you seen, because you know they're published, and that's how cell phone novelists, the ones who became famous, made money, because advertising is one way to make money from platforms, but the real money is in getting your book published, that some of which sold 1 or 2 million copies. Oh. And fans say that they buy them because of the emotional attachment to the story. So they want to own the book themselves. But it's interesting how they are printed. Like, the paper is different, and the font color is usually not black. And so they try to kind of, even the book format tries to depart from the traditional book format. Yeah,
that is very interesting. And just like how big social media companies in the U.S. have created numerous social problems, Japanese digital economy also contributed to issues such as inequality and pay gap. Can you elaborate on this point a bit more? What are some of the problems, and what are some potential solutions to these problems?
And by pay gap, you mean, what exactly do you mean?
So in your book, you mentioned how women, there are people for net idols, for bloggers, for cell phone novelists, there are women who are contributing to these contents. But some don't get as successful as their fellow women writers. And sometimes all these achievements are just taken by men. And
that's right.
Women So financially, they're not really gaining according to the amount of time that they put in.
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm not sure how to answer it, because this is one of those questions that you would need to look at. It's ongoing, right? Like, because to me, the question is, and it's a very good question in the sense that I'm wondering, so the reason why I can't answer the question is that I imagine that some of these women who became famous through developing digital DIY careers in the digital economy might actually help alter perceptions that you know, women are not as efficient as they could be. Or I'm thinking about something like Ogasawara Yuko's work about office ladies, that in which is a book I like a lot, in which she argues that the problem with systemic gender discrimination at Japanese corporations is that it's very difficult to mount a kind of unified protest or resistance against them. So often women are involved in what Ogasawara calls like offstage resistance. They jam the copier and they slow down work. But that form of resistance reinforces stereotypes that women are not responsible and they're not committed to work. And I'm thinking that the couriers, some of these famous digital entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs developed, might also defy the conceptions that women are not committed to work and might kind of inspire changes in how women as workers, or women as individuals who are interested in developing careers are seen in Japan. And of course, this, you know, in Japan, there's a problem with population decline, and the Abe's Viminomics, or what is it, Viminomics, or whatever Abe called it, this idea that women need to be incorporated in the labor force in larger numbers, because Japan still has very inflexible immigration policies and labor is an issue. But the question is, yeah, women have been participating in the labor force, but in kind of flexible in arrangements, in ways in which they had a hard time seeing work as something meaningful or something that is a source of self-growth, right? Because they were largely, throughout the post-war period, they were largely marginalized from career stream employment. So I wonder if that kind of changes, but also these internet-based careers, they also destabilize the idea that what constitutes a courier, that it's not the kind of courier that you apply for in April and you start working for a corporation and then start moving up the corporate ladder. That's like, there are other careers that you can make for yourself. So in that sense, you hope that some of those changes will happen, but who knows? Who knows? I think the argument I tried to make in the book was that in digital labor is gendered, and how digital labor, how the digital economy, what opportunities the digital economy provides for its men and women users is not the same everywhere. And then this whole idea of technological utopianism is very tricky.
Thank you.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I definitely hope to see changes brought by such a digital economy that's led by women, and how they, I look forward to see it transforming the idea of working in Japan in the future. But thank you so much again for joining us today.
I'm sorry if we went over time. I apologize.
No, we're totally fine.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And listeners, if you're interested in finding out more about women and digital labor in Japan, make sure to check out Invisibility by Design, Women and Labor in Japan's Digital Economy by Dr. Gabriela Lukacs. This is Jeannie from New Books in Japanese Studies. Stay tuned for our next episode.